Hi, this is Zach and Jane, and we are doing something a little bit different this time for our third part of this series of podcasts. Basically, I mentioned before, we talked for a really long time, and by the time we got to this point in our conversation, I think we were both a little exhausted, so we weren't making a lot of sense. And there was also, I think, and we'll talk about this later, there was also some trepidation to discuss certain things, because there is kind of, even though Prince is dead, there's kind of a pressure, you know, to keep certain things private. And I think we were both subconsciously trying to avoid. So there was basically
a lot of pussyfooting.
Exactly. There was a lot of talking around issues that could have been addressed directly. And, you know, basically nobody wants to hear people do that for
an
2 hours.
An hour and a half of us talking in tangents and ellipses. Yeah.
So we've spent the last couple of weeks getting our courage up, and we're going to take another stab at this. So first, I'm going to drop in our conversation, our brief conversation about Maite's book. And then we're going to kind of try and transition from there into the other things that we wanted to talk about, which I think connect very well. Part of it is our feelings, you know, from last April about Prince's death. And then part of it is maybe a little bit of discussion about, you know, why it happened, which is what we were afraid to talk about before. So,
yeah, Prince Posthumous Mind Control is serious stuff, it turns out. We're not saying anything bad, honestly. We're just trying to understand.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I hope that we're seen as not being disrespectful. You know, I don't think we're not trying to be controversial, or, you know, we're not trying to violate anyone's private life or anything like that, you know, but I think things need to be discussed. The way that he died was not a way that he should have died, clearly. And it kind of left this hole in everyone, and I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors by trying to dance around it. So we're not going to be talking about, like, the Illuminati killed him or anything like that. But we are going to talk a little bit about sort of the defense mechanisms that might have created a situation where something like this could happen.
It's interesting, actually, because I was thinking about this. It's just a little kind of related aside. Channel 5 made this docudrama thing, and a friend of mine reminded...
Right.
Yeah, no, I don't know if you've heard about it. A friend of mine made this, kind of reminded me about it. And I when I'd heard about it, I was like, I'm not going to watch it. And then, you know, my little lesser little demony creatures were just like... And oh my god, I mean, not only is, like, there should be an international statute against Prince impersonation, it just shouldn't be allowed.
I think I saw a screenshot of the guy.
I mean, the most bare and, like, superficial resemblance, but, like,
right,
he was like a charisma black hole, and and he couldn't sing, and he couldn't move, and he had no grace, and it was horrible. But also, I mean, the reason why I think it was interesting in relation to what we're talking about, what we're going to talk about, is, you know, they wanted to tell a story about, you know, his childhood and how it had affected him. And then they created this narrative about how horrifically emotionally crippled he was and completely failed to pay any attention to all the amazingness and treat him with any respect. And it was exactly the kind of horrific, gratuitous, salacious, like tabloid bullshit that, you know,
right,
you know, would have made him scream his head off.
Which I think is like, that's, I speaking for myself, that was kind of what was holding me back. I didn't want it to sound like I was doing that.
Exactly. And the thing that was really marked about it, and I think kind of, you know, I hope we've established, you know, how much respect we have for him before we even start. The thing that was kind of amazing about that was they were telling this story about this, like, you know, awfully emotionally crippled person who lived this horribly emotionally, you know, kind of destitute life. And then every time they would cut from like this charisma black hole actor to a picture of Pete looking fucking luminous, and kind of go, I think you're missing something quite important about this story.
and that's the thing, and I think that's why we led with why we care about him, why he's important, because I mean, there's a lot of people who are emotionally crippled, you know, and there's a lot more people who are emotionally crippled than there are people like Prince. If it was just about his problems, then we wouldn't be talking about him for hours,
and the version of the problems was horrible as well. Their particular reconstruction of the versions of the problems. And there was all this kind of nasty, sleazy stuff about his sexual ambiguity, and then implying that anyway, and then they mocked up the death scene, and I didn't watch it, and then I wanted to rip people's heads off. Seriously, I was like, there is a special circle of hell for people who even think about doing that. So I didn't
see,
get
that's too it's too soon for me. Like I love a true Hollywood story. I like bad reenactments, but like, give me a couple of years before, like a year after is just in horrible taste.
It's
so
it was in horrible taste. The version of the story that they told was, you know, was very different from the version that we're going to tell. There was all this bullshit about his father and the epilepsy and how ashamed he was made to feel about being epileptic because his father thought he was possessed by a demon. It was all kinds of bullshit. I mean, it was just awful.
Right.
And how he was sexually confused. Oh, and then at one point they went, oh yes, and because, you know, Prince just, you know, he had this great sexual persona, but really it just seemed to a lot of people that he didn't really like sex. And we were like, I'm not sure where you're getting your facts from, but I think you might have just lost all credibility. it was horrible. We're not doing that. That's not what we're doing.
So I just hope that we've bought the goodwill with our first, you know, two installments, and you know, this time we're going to be more honest, but also I think I trust us to not be too, you know, in bad taste or anything like that. So
I think it's important. I do think it's important to talk about these things because, you know, as we will discuss, and I think a lot of people feel, the amount of repression around things was a contributing factor possibly to the way in which things ended up. And that might not be something that, you know, we want to repeat.
Exactly.
And I think it, you know, it's helpful for people to process things by being able to understand them in ways that make sense or allow people to make sense of things, because it felt so inexplicable when it happened and was so thunderbolt like and incomprehensible and shocking. So yes, okay, so where do we begin?
All right, so let's be before we go, you know, before we play back what we already recorded about the Maite book. Time has passed since the last time we got together, and though neither of us were at the anniversary, you know, the celebration event in Minneapolis, we were aware of what was going on, and I think it's worth kind of acknowledging that that happened. And one thing that, and this will tie into what we've been talking about and what we'll continue to talk about, this idea of being, you know, being open and discussing things and not repressing them. One of the things that really struck me was we had these panel discussions with, you know, everybody. There was all, you know, former members of his bands, people who used to work with him. I don't think the family was involved with any of the panel discussions, but people who were in the inner circle at one point or another, and it was all kind of done under the endorsement of the estate. And, you know, the thing, if you know anything about Prince, you know that all of these people had signed non-disclosure agreements when they parted ways with him, because that's just what he did as a common practice. Like, you know, not only business partners, but his wives were under gag orders after they divorced, you know. And I mean, that's a reason why Maite's book didn't come out until it came out. And I thought what was so interesting about it to me was, you know, these were people who were literally like not allowed to share these stories while Prince was alive, and nothing they shared was, you know, was disturbing or seemed, you know, crass or tasteless or overly critical in any way. It was, you know, it was a celebration. It was as billed. And the fact that they could be frank didn't drag any skeletons out of the closet. Like, it was all very respectful. And I think that kind of, that says something about, you know, maybe all of this silence and, you know, that this whole idea of Prince was a private person and we need to respect that. I mean, yes, that is true in the sense that we probably shouldn't be making documentaries with bad reenactments about him. And, you know, kind of like these like tabloid stories about, you know, there are always like tasteful and tasteless ways to discuss anything.
Yeah.
But I think he used that privacy sometimes as a, I mean, almost as a weapon or as a way to keep people out and to avoid any kind of, reflection on himself, you know, like it was a way to kind of keep his own feelings repressed. And, you know, I mean, again, like not to speak out of turn, but we saw what happened with that.
Yeah.
You know, there was no reason for, and I think one of the reasons why people were so shocked is there was no reason for a, you know, a man in his 50s was in pain, but was not, you know, deathly ill. He was in reasonably good health, you know, wealthy. I mean, there was no reason for him to die like he did, you know?
No.
And I think that the secrecy, played a role in that. It put him in a situation where that kind of unthinkable thing was possible.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was one of the crucial factors. I mean, people talk about that a lot about the extent to which he said the same thing in the letter to Maite, like, just to let you know, people only get to disagree with me once and and then they're not here anymore.
Right.
And the extent to which, I mean, I was listening to one of the Peach and Black podcasts the other day. I think it was the Deliverance review. They were talking about that as well. I mean, just from their small dealings, you know, with the edges of his circle and, you know, small dealings with him, like the extent to which everyone surrounding him were employed for their refusal to say no,
right,
or to challenge him in any way. And that's not healthy for any human being. That really isn't. There's an extent to which the refusal to talk about it is a repetition of a set of injunctions and a set of behaviours which feel to me like they are implicated in things ending the way that they did. And I don't necessarily think it's a question. I mean, we've also talked about this. The extent to which, you know, our complicity in this or not is not the issue. Like, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But... But I mean, the fact that the extent to which we still experience a kind of sense of posthumous mind control from someone we've never even met, like, is pretty telling. Like, the sense of fear of doing something he wouldn't like, and I feel it really strongly. And I mean, I think we both do.
I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop on my blog, to be honest, whether it's the estate, you know, sending a cease and desist for talking about bootlegs, or whether it's, even just fans getting upset with me for analyzing things because Prince didn't like things to be analyzed, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
and I've honestly been surprised by how positive the response has been so far, but I'm still kind of waiting for the inevitable backlash, because I've seen how kind of sensitive the community can be about any kind of, you know.
I mean Funkenberry and Michael Dean as well. I'm not wishing to take pot shots at them particularly, but I listened to Alex's interview when Alex came on, and, you know, when Alex mentioned what evidence there was of drug use in the 90s, Michael Dean was immediately like, no, we're not talking about that. And moving swiftly onwards, because, you know, it immediately becomes, oh, you're calling him a junkie. And it's like, no one's calling him a junkie. No one has ever, I have not seen, the only people I have seen use that word in relation to Prince are people complaining about people calling Prince that word. Like, no one has used that word. And you know, the 100% positivity thing, and I'm just the 100% positivity thing was a serious problem, and no one's life is 100% positive, and that's really an issue, and there is a desire to be honest about it, and it's not out of disrespect. It's out of wanting to understand and possibly having a slightly different perspective, which, you know, Prince also believed that people should be true to themselves, and it is part of my truth to not shy away from that stuff. So I don't wish to do so in relation to this. And there are a lot of people who also don't wish to. There has been some very useful and constructive and respectful conversations. And then there's been a lot of craziness and freaking out and insane conspiracy theories.
And I think that they're coming from the same place. This might be something that we discussed last time that we're now replacing. I seem to remember having a conversation about this, but the conspiracy theories are a way to kind of fill the vacuum of this, you know, shock that, like, he seemed totally fine. I mean, you can look back and see warning signs, you know, he was very thin.
In my crazy obsessiveness, I actually went back, I went back and did a timeline and compared all of the photographs and the performance history and all the other information that we had to try and work out exactly what was going on. And he was from 2013, from the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, he starts to look not well. And by 2015, end of 2015, he looks very not well. Very thin, and his eyes are very flat, and the general, like, luminosity, which is so marked most of the time, is not there. He becomes very flat. Not when he's performing. When he's performing, it's still there, but the rest of the time, there's a very marked flatness, particularly in his eyes, which, you know, is very notable. I mean, there were a few people who say that they noticed and they thought that he didn't look well, and other people said, "Oh no, he's right. just thin, or he's just been working too hard, or you know." And he had been very thin before, so
right.
Yeah, I mean, there are. I think to all intents and purposes, it came completely out of the blue. I mean, I think that's one of the things that was. I mean, I wrote some notes about why it was so shocking, and that was one of the points. Because everyone right. else that, not everyone else, but most people, it's not unusual for rock stars to die in these circumstances. There is something about performers yeah. and, you know, something going on with the structure of their personalities, which is also to do with the drive towards performance, which very often there is some kind of correlation between mm-hmm. something they're moving away from or something they're trying to compensate for or some kind of gap they're trying to fill and the desire to fill that gap through performance. So that's not an unusual constellation, you know. We have lots of instances of that. But in most cases of that, there were lots of signs, you know. Janis Joplin or Amy Winehouse or Kurt Cobain or any of these, those were not shocks. Those were like, oh damn.
I mean, even Michael Jackson, he was young I always say Michael Jackson was shocking, but not surprising.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Like I was
exactly.
Cause he seemed to be declining for a very long exactly. time. You know, if anything, it was more surprising that he was, you know, when I saw This Is It, it was more surprising to see how vital he still
yeah.
was right before yeah. he died. But, you know, Prince was not that.
No,
he seemed to have it together.
And not only did he seem to have it together, he seemed to have it really, really together. Like, I mean, I think that's why right. it was so. I mean, firstly, were there no signs? I mean, again, yeah. To the extent to which we missed them.
And the other side of that, And the reason why there's so much kind of denial is because he was always, you know, virulently anti-drug. Yeah. You know, he cut anyone out of his camp if they were abusing drugs. And he never seemed to be under the influence, you
yeah.
know, so you kind of got this, you get this idea that, oh, well, you know, Prince is a teetotaler. So there's no way that he would overdose on drugs. And I think the shock and then the denial based on, you know, we know that he doesn't do drugs, ergo he didn't do drugs, you know, has created this vacuum for all of these other theories, whether it's, you know, I don't want to say anything libelous, so I'm not going to be explicit about any of the theories, but you know, somebody had him killed, like some yeah. like yeah. you know, I mean there's all kinds of crazy stories out there, and I think those are coming from the same place as us, as you making a timeline of how he looked. You know, we're all trying to like fill the, like trying to make sense of it. And
I think there is a slight, I think
there's different directions you can go.
I think there is a difference though. I mean, and we have also discussed this briefly, which is the extent to which the refusal of the, you know, really relatively conclusive, you know, at least strong enough for us to draw a very clear inference information. And the the refusal of that information is also tied up with, I mean, I said that's one of the things I also found so shocking was the degree of moralism that was around it, in mm. terms of people just refusing to believe it was possible because, you know, because he couldn't be a drug addict, because drug addicts are other
right.
people, drug addicts are bad people, drug addicts are dirty people, yeah. drug addicts are people who cannot get their shit together, who don't contribute anything meaningful, mm. who don't produce amazing pieces of art, do not give to charity, do not do any of the great things that we respect about Prince. So therefore, because Prince was not a bad person in that moralistic sense, he couldn't have had an addiction. Mm. And therefore there must be some
right.
other explanation. And That I found really, really difficult, because, you know, and I think maybe I do wonder about the extent to which that's related to difference between European and American attitudes, because I think European attitudes to addiction are much more centered around the idea that it's an illness and that it's caused by mental distress of some type, and that it's a not functional but deserving of compassion coping strategy that some people use that they need help with, not that it's some inherent kind of moral failing or some form of degeneracy or dirtiness. And that I have found quite distressing, like the extent to which it both is distressing in itself, and also it's then distressing to watch people tie themselves in mental pretzels to try and explain this event, which was very, very shocking because he always had his shit together and was so perfectly immaculate and controlled, and that we had no sense that this was going on, really, that it came like a huge, massive detonation in the middle of a perfectly maintained exterior, and it just feels like someone just dropped a bomb. Like, that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah it
felt like, and I think that's also kind of to a certain extent why we've ended up engaging in the kind of, as you said, you know, paddling around in the psychic Lake Minnetonka exercise, because it feels to me that it has to, that's the only place we can look for an explanation. The only place we can look for an explanation is in his own mechanisms, like what it was in his personality that produced that set of circumstances. And I mean, I think I feel like those of us who have been doing that have kind of collectively pieced together a story which we more or less seem to agree on and is kind of explanatory. It makes me very sad. And I don't find it, you know, there's nothing salacious or anything about it, and I don't find it. It's a very human story. It's a very human story. It produces a lot of sadness and compassion in me, but I do find it. It does make sense. It is possible to make sense of it. It is possible to take what we know and what we have come to know over the last year and put the pieces together and make a story that makes sense of that event. And some people don't need to do that. It's fine. There are some fans who are just like, just celebrate the life. Why do you keep doing this? Stop psychoanalyzing him. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I'm fine. That's okay. If you're okay with this and you don't need an explanation, then fine. But there are some people who do need an explanation. And for some of us, this is how we have produced an explanation.
And it's the type of people that we are, you know, Jane, you're a PhD or a, whatever they call it in England, a doctor of philosophy. Yeah.
All of the above.
Right. I tried to be I was at one point, you know, trying to be a PhD. We're people that compulsively
analyze shit.
I've been in therapy most of my adult life, and so you know, this is just the type of person I am. And I know that Prince had, you know, a fair amount of contempt for people like me, and that's okay. He had a fair amount of contempt for people who wear jeans too, and you know, I wear jeans. so you know, I think it's different strokes, and I definitely I'm all for, you know, just celebrating the life, but for some of us, you know, trying to make sense of this is going to make it easier for us to celebrate his life.
This
is something we kind of have to
do. It has made it easier for me. It took a while, and there are a lot of little bits and pieces, and there are still little bits where I'm super puzzled. And obviously, I mean, this is a narrative that we have constructed. Like, it is an evidence-based narrative. It's not something we've just like pulled out of thin air. And we have quite a lot of good evidence for it. And other people who have studied the same evidence have come to similar conclusions. But again, I mean, it's like what you do in therapy, you know, you're constructing a story, and to a certain extent, you recognize that it's a construction. It's not a flim-flam construction that comes out of nowhere, but it's still a narrative that you're making. But it's helpful. You know, those narratives are helpful. Human beings need to make stories. Like, it's one of the things that we do. Yeah. Mm. I mean, songwriting is storytelling as well. Like, you know, he wasn't entirely adverse to storytelling.
No, and he wasn't entirely adverse to autobiography. One of the things that's been very striking about kind of taking a deep dive into his music after the fact is, you know, the cliche is that Prince is an enigma and he, you know, didn't share anything of himself. But actually, so much of his music is profoundly autobiographical, right on the surface. Like, you don't even have to dig very deep.
And I also, I also wonder about these. I mean, there's the issue to which there is the privacy thing in general, and I get that. Yeah, I get not wanting your life to be turned into like currency for gossip. Yeah, like I totally understand that. I'm that kind of person. Yeah, I do not like let random people who I am only vaguely acquainted with know my personal business. Like, I don't want it to be used as counters. Like, I understand that. Like, I also understand, you know, and that's what, you know, that's what a lot of the media consists of is, you know, that's what this documentary that I watched was. There was no respect and no compassion and no real concern. It was just like, ooh, look at this story. Like, there's that. And like, I understand that about him, but then there's also storytelling and the importance of narrative to the way in which humans understand their lives. And it's perfectly possible to write very respectful, very detailed biographical accounts of people's lives, which can tell us really important and interesting things about the human condition. And I think his story is fascinating. I really do. And the more I got into it, the more fascinating I found it. And moving. And a lot of the evidence that we've used is evidence that he gave us. I mean, like, yeah, like, he didn't want people tittle-tattling, for sure.
Right.
But there was very little. And there was also, you know, so much of like, oh, he's a weird, freaky genius. I mean, there was a lot of bullshit that people talked about him, and not particularly respectful bullshit, and bullshit that was, like, very focused on how eccentric and bizarre and unusual his behavior was, and characterized him in very two-dimensional terms, and was quite lazy and never really bothered to try and understand him. And like, I get it. I get that he wouldn't like that. Like, no one likes being caricatured.
Right.
So anyway,
and that's another thing about what we've been doing is I've found, you know, whether it's reading a lot of the texts that are out there about Prince, or whether it's, you know, writing, like thinking my way through the songs and his life, you know, like I always tell people, this is not, what I'm doing is not a biographical project. It's an analysis of his songs with biography as a sort of necessary backdrop, you know? But I have found it to be very humanizing, and I found it to be demystifying in a lot of ways. And I think one of the really striking things for me is that, you know, the human condition, is not, it feels more complex, I think, than it actually is in some ways. and there's just, you know, there's so many things about his story that just make sense, and that are almost much simpler than you would expect them to be.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a very, in some ways, a very universal and very human story. And I think that's also what's interesting about it. I think this is the last point about why his death was so shocking. A lot of people said this about him. It's because of, you know, and the thing that we've talked about his higher self and the otherworldliness and the energetic properties and his spiritual capacities and him being such a ridiculous, like, on top of things all the time badass. Like, people were like, this guy was not supposed to die. Like, this guy was supposed to, like, dematerialize in a puff of, like, purple smoke. Like, or be, like, beamed up by, like, a choir of little purple cherubims.
It's like when Bowie died, too. It's like he would go back to space, you know? Like, his work here was done. And he died of cancer, you know?
But Bowie's death was still much more... Bowie's death was much more choreographed. Bowie's death was...
Right.
Bowie's death was, like... I was shocked that he was... But I wasn't shocked by the way he died. I mean, okay, he had cancer. But... Firstly, he died.
It was like conceptual art almost.
It was a piece of conceptual art. And released it, and the thing, and the Lazarus, and the. I mean, it was like he made a work of art out of it. And I think, I mean, this is also why I'm I'm certain that Prince didn't kill himself, because if he had decided to do so, which I don't think he ever would, but had he decided to do so, it would have been perfectly choreographed. Like, would have been a choir of purple cherubins.
Yeah. The curtain blowing in the wind.
There would have been curtains blowing and bathtub and like vases of lilies and like choirs and like the whole thing. Like, it would have been a work of art. He would have done it in the way he did everything else as an aesthetic statement. I was like, there is no way that was a decision that man would have made. Never. Not in a million years.
That's one of the things I don't think we talked about with the Maite book, but you know, the first chapter of Maite's book is a difficult read. You know, it's very, you can tell how overpowered, you know, she was emotionally. And she's talking about getting the news, and you know, she's talking it, and she's connecting it to lyrics from Paisley Park, and one of the things she talks about is the kind of the most horrifying thing for her was knowing that you know, part of the coroner's report was that his clothes were on backwards, which anyone who was even vaguely aware of Prince, like,
never,
there's no way, you know, like, no.
There's no way in 100,000 million years that man would have decided the last image that people have of him in their minds to be that. Never.
Right.
Never.
Right.
It's so spectacularly out of character. No. Just no. Yeah. Like, that was not a decision. That was an explosion.
Yeah.
I think that's what made it so hard. Yeah, I mean, it was just and anybody that, yeah, that's what I think also. Yeah, I mean, the thing about that image is that you don't, it is literally obscene. Like, it's and those things are always, to a certain extent, worse, the things that, you know, it's, anyway, should we talk about the stuff that we're still talking about?
Yeah, are we done with did you have anything else to say about the anniversary or any of that?
Yeah, I wanted to say, I think the only thing, I think what I wanted to share, and I mean, maybe this also reflects back on, it's been, I mean, and I think, you know, some of the comments below the blog have kind of borne testimony to that. It's been a very powerful experience for a lot of people, for various reasons. And for me and for you and for many other people who were very touched by it and who had a lot of stuff brought up by it, and working through the story and trying to come to some sense of accommodation or peace with it. Not that it, you know, it's not that it will be all right, but some way of feeling all right about it not being all right, or it being comprehensible, or narrativizing it in a way that makes it something that you can hold, at least. And anyway, yeah, I actually ended up feeling really joyful that day and grateful. I think deliverance helped. This is not religion, but common sense. It's time for you to get down. Get off the beat. No son should die, no mother should cry. All in favor, say aye. Because time's so hard to do. Because that's a stellarly uplifting piece of music.
Yeah.
And it was quite, you know, there's all the issues about that and whether it should be released and blah, blah. I don't care. Thank you for whoever gave that to us.
Yeah, I mean, it's another bootleg. I've never had a problem with
it. Seemed very appropriate that day. And yeah, I listened to that a lot. I felt grateful, I think. Deliverance was delivered and I played it a lot that morning and I lit some candles. And I danced around quite a bit and I felt quite joyful and grateful, both for some of the things that I have experienced over the last year and for what we were left, and for the community of people that have been created, or both through the experience afterwards and the experience before. And then I went out and drank 5 pints and danced all the hits, and it was awesome in a really like sticky floor dive bar that P would have hated. and then suddenly was like, oh my god, I now feel like totally bad about all the things I said about everything that was important, because I haven't listened to the hits all year, and I've just been obsessed with like ferreting out obscure bootlegs, and right. Oh my god, this shit is amazing, and I'd forgotten, and like I never gave it credit. I got slightly annoyed they didn't play Shockadelica, but it was all right, because afterwards we sat under a tree and listened to it on our iPhone and listened to sometimes.
I think I was texting you at that time.
We were talking on Facebook, and I was like, I had 4 pints by this point, so I was like, well, there's no Shockadelica. But it was great. They played Nuddle of a Hole in Your Head, and they played Dorothy Parker, and they played Head, and they played I Want to Be Your Lover, and we jumped up and down and slopped beer around, and then at the end they played Purple Rain, and we got in a big cheesy stadium bundle, and then everyone started doing the woo woo woos before the guitar solo, and like a complete Prince gig, I started going, no, there's a guitar solo, stop, this is like premature ejaculation, you are not allowed to do this. And then of course gave up, apart from the bit where the really important bit in the guitar solo, like, and then they all stopped and did that bit right, and that was okay, and then we went back to the woo 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 woos, and it was cheesy and glorious, and I left, and then we sat under a tree and into Shockadelica, and sometimes it snows in April, and it felt good, it felt all right.
I was not super, like, I was not very productive. I mean, that was the day that I posted the podcast, and I was like distracted by that, you know?
Yeah.
The first episode of the podcast, but it wasn't really an especially sad. I was thinking, you know, I was listening to a lot of his music and thinking about Prince a lot, but I wasn't like despondent or anything like that. And so, there's two things about that. I think one is I've seen a lot of, you know, the talk around, I mean, there are a lot of things to take issue with about the celebration. And, you know, part of it is honestly just sour grapes on my part, because I can't afford a $500 ticket. And so much as I'd like to go, it's not going to happen.
It should cost $40 to go to Paisley Park. That's how much Prince would have charged you. That's how much. I know they need to keep the place open, but like $1,000, like for a VIP pass, like,
I really do hope that that price goes down, because I would love insane. To go, but I just can't, you know,
just
no. So, I mean, there's reasons to object, but one of the objections I've seen is, why is it in April? Like, why aren't we celebrating his life instead of his death? And it's like, I understand that sort of, but I think there's something to be said about taking a date that was so, you know, depressing for so many of us last year, and turning it into something joyous, you know, why not? Like,
I think it's important to mark it. And then we also have the 6th of June. So we have 2 Prince days a year, and that, how can that be a bad thing?
Exactly.
We'll be rocking up on Facebook and then, going, happy Prince Day. And everyone's going to be like, again? We're like, yes, again.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, there's been, and I wrote about this a little bit when I saw the Revolution last week.
Oh, that was a great review, by the way.
There's something sort of liberating about being able to celebrate Prince on our terms now. Like, you know, it was so awesome to be out there and hear Erotic City. It's like, my God, I haven't been able to hear a live band play Erotic City since the year 2000. Like, you know, like since Larry Graham got in the picture, basically. Like, and so, you know, it was like, No disrespect to his beliefs. I can kind of understand. I understand that idea of like getting older and realizing like that you're not fully comfortable with your legacy. You know, that whole story about like Questlove telling Prince that he taught him how to swear and Prince being like, ugh, you know, like I can understand that being like, that's my legacy, like teaching kids dirty words. You know, I don't necessarily agree with it because I don't think there's anything wrong with dirty words necessarily, but I can sort of understand it. But it's like, that's such an essential part of who he was. And
yeah,
it did feel kind of like there was a weight off of us, like, oh, you know, now we can sing. Instead of that, you know, like when I saw him in 2004 and he played DMSR, he sang like "Shake It Like You Want Some More" or something. It's just like, ugh, you know, like
some of the rewrites didn't even make sense. I know what he did with the titties line in Peach, but it was just nonsense.
Right. And it's like you want some more what? That's still a suggestive line. Like, you know, like
so oh bless. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think that comes back to the same thing as well. I mean, it's like you have to, there's that contradiction, you know, between that whole kind of him wanting people to speak their truth and honor themselves and be themselves, and people coming and saying, you know, the thing that he taught me more than anything else was to be myself. And then his whole like, no, but you have to interact with me in only exactly the way in which I determine it is correct to do so.
Right. Right.
Like, well, I'd rather not. I'd rather interact with you in the way that feels meaningful and right for me. And mostly that includes singing the swear words in your songs.
Right. Right.
So sorry about that. Could you be?
The day, turn the to the last day of all time. I can say, I hope you're in these arms of mine. When the night falls before that day, tears of joy, all one can do is die.
Let's talk about Mighty.
Okay. I don't have a lot to say. My main thing is just that so much of the conversation around the book has been, should it have been written, you know? And I just think that's a non-starter to me, you know? Like, of course, she has every right to write the book. About and on top of that, life. it's very good. You know, I mean, it's like, it's fascinating.
Yeah. It is.
I think if there's a criticism to it, it's that maybe you don't see as much of, you know, Prince, the artist, as one might prefer. But I mean, I think that also she was having to write about, she was more than just a collaborator with him, you know, and I think I'm sure the more important aspects of the relationship to her were, you know, the children they lost and, you know, their marriage and it was also her story. So she was telling things entirely from her perspective.
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of it's not a trashy book. It's not a tell all. It's not tabloidy at all.
Yeah.
It's very deeply felt. It's a very moving book. I think the criticism of it, I haven't seen anyone who's actually read the book criticize it. I'll put it that way.
I've seen very few people. Most people who have the criticism are just point blank refusing to read it, either because they right. consider it to be an act of betrayal or because they consider it to be an act of egregious gold digging. On the betrayal point, she didn't say anything while he was alive. She respected his wishes.
Right.
And he's not here now. And
which must have been very painful. You know,
it must have been incredibly painful, because then you have people who are kind of, you know, people are like saying, well, why would she want to do, you know, there could only be one reason. There could only be a financial reason for doing this. And it's like, firstly, if she wants to make money out of her own life story, then like, fine. Like, I have no problem with that. Like, she has a child to support. Like, it was her life. She went through a very traumatic situation. She spent 20 years putting herself back together. She wants to make some money out of it now. All power to her.
Yeah.
And secondly, why would she do it? Because she wants it to be witnessed. Because she had to keep silent for 17 years. And she not had to. She could have written it. She obviously loves him. She obviously still loves him. I mean, she owns that in a very straightforward way. And I have a lot of respect for her for doing that. And so she respected his wishes, which meant she couldn't ask for people to witness her own story, even though that story was circulating in the public domain.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that's the thing. There's not any like huge revelations in the book. We all basically know what happened. Even with Prince's second wife, I mean, do the math. You know, they got married like a year after that, or less than a year after he and
we all knew that at the end of their relationship he had behaved abominably. We all knew that,
right?
Like, and you know, that was not complicated. I mean, there is nothing in the book that is. I mean, everyone's just like, oh, you're tarnished. It's like, no. I mean, as we've said, he comes out of it as exactly the person I thought he would come out of it as, you know, as an incredibly exceptional, tender, artistically driven, obsessive, playful, kind of wondrous person who had severe personality flaws in certain areas and very poor life coping strategies in certain respects,
right.
which led him to be an asshole sometimes. Like,
right.
tell us something we don't know. Like, she's incredibly, you know, she's very honest. She describes his behavior from her own, you know, her own perspective, very straightforwardly, I think. She doesn't sugarcoat anything. She has incredible equanimity about it. Which I was really impressed with and kind of warmed my heart, because I was like, wow, you've survived this really well to have this level of equanimity.
Yeah.
You know, that was something. I have a lot of respect for that as well. It's not like she's told us, I mean, yeah, she didn't tell us anything we didn't know. Like, Prince could be an asshole sometimes, like, newsflash.
Right. Right.
You know, he abandoned his wife while she was like bereaved.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
and that's just something
obvious.
Right. And avoiding that be out of some, you know, desire to, I don't know, to respect his memory. I guess I don't fully comprehend why that would be.
There's several weird things. One is that there's a lot of misogyny in the whole gold digging accusation. Let's just say that.
Right.
Secondly, there is, I mean, and I think this relates to the point that you were making about Christianity and about there not being people either being like, no, I don't get it, or like, oh, he was completely right. There is a kind of deification around him, which is not unrelated to, I think, you know, what I would describe as his spiritual power, but then leads to this idea that he was therefore like a saint, you know, mm-hmm. and that we must therefore say nothing bad about him. And to say anything bad is, you know, is to disrespect his name or to tarnish his legacy, or, you know, which, I mean, I understand people want to have questions about, like, okay, so on one hand, he was clearly an extremely kind-hearted person and very generous mm-hmm. and really cared about people and was a good man in significant respects, and mm-hmm. also had certain kinds of, you know, almost otherworldly capacities for a certain type of ecstatic spiritual kind of way of being. And then he had a normal personality with, you know, and possibly a more dysfunctional than normal personality in terms of his range of coping skills.
Right.
And somehow, you know, maybe it's difficult for people to hold those things together. There are some tensions between them, sure. But like we say, this was all there. I mean, like, it's not like, you know, the evidence of these tensions was not already present. I mean, I think what comes through, one of the things that comes through clearly from that book is just how recognisable he is. It's like, oh yeah, this is exactly how I would have think he would be. This is exactly how I would have thought he would have behaved in these particular sets of seconds. The way he treated Mighty is appalling and has no excuse, but it's very, very understandable given who he was.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
he had no coping skills for something of that magnitude at all, other than work and sex.
Yeah.
And in the last resort, drugs.
Like, right.
And that's a question in itself, you know. But I understand why he would have behaved in that way. I don't excuse it. I don't excuse it, but I think it's comprehensible and not surprising.
If you're looking for a man, walk away from responsibility, yeah. I ain't the one, no, no, no. If you're looking for a brother, treat you like anything but a natural queen. Oh, mama, I ain't the one. Oh, no, no, change. If you're looking for a man, sweep you off your tired feet.
I think we're in a time or maybe it's not time related. Maybe it's just something about our culture in general. But there's kind of a feeling that someone either is the best person or the worst possible, you know, like just garbage. You know, you're either a saint or you're a monster. And this comes up a lot with famous people, especially famous men, because, you know, quite frankly, you know, when geniuses are given unlimited power, they tend to do monstrous things, you know. But so in some ways, I actually think Prince gets off the hook a little bit, because I don't see as much of the, you know, so like with John Lennon, it was like he was a saint, and then he was like, now it's almost like,
yeah,
you can't say anything positive about John Lennon because it's like, well, did you know he beat his wife? You know, it's like, well, yeah. And he was an asshole, and he, you know, did a lot of soul searching about that. Like that really was a, you know, it was a torment to him, you know,
yeah.
Which doesn't excuse anything he did. But I'm not any more convinced by the he was a monster explanation than the he was a saint explanation. I don't see very many people calling Prince a monster, which is kind of heartening in a way. But I think people are afraid to let go of the idea that he was a saint.
Yes. Yeah, they are. And like I said, I think it's partly because he had, you know, in certain respects, very profound spiritual kind of capacities.
Yeah.
You know. What we can call that, like his higher self or whatever, like that thing was amazing. Like it was made of some kind of crazy shiny gold weave substance. Like I don't know what that was. Like it was from outer space. But that's very different from his personality, actually. And you know, you can hold those things together. Like that.
Right.
That part of him. Which is not the only part of him that we connect to, but I think is also one of the parts that we connect to. And, you know, yet we don't connect to very often Prince the Asshole, because mostly he kept that out of the music. But, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. People, I mean, and it's interesting when you're talking about, like I said at the beginning, you know, when you're talking about someone who, you know, who started out from this position of, like, you know, holding these things that are not supposed to be held together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's partly to do with like his own non-toleration of the negative aspects of his personality as well, or how he processed them. And they're very in a lot of respects when he was, you know, behaving badly. I hate using that phrase. Men behaving badly. it's quite destructive. It seems, you know, it's quite destructive to him as well. It's not like Trumpian, you know, straightforward domination, like, you know, extortion. Right. It's not those types of things that take cold malice. You know, it's dysfunction. It's like, I can't cope with this.
Right.
I can't cope with this, so I'm going to escape. Like, I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know how to process this. So I will process it using the processing techniques that I have. And I will withdraw. Like, there's a very... Yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing. It's the moving on thing. It's the time does not exist thing. It's the keep going forward. Mm. You know, it's... And there's a question about that. You know, so there's a question about... You know, it comes back to the whole computer blue thing. It's like, you know what the problem is, so why haven't you looked? Why won't you look at it? Why won't you look directly at it? Why do you keep just running away? Because, and I think to a certain extent, maybe it's because actually his coping strategies were sufficiently powerful and effective to allow him to keep running away. They worked.
They could sustain him.
They sustained him enough. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
But he was isolated, you know, he's alone in Paisley Park when he dies, you know, like.
Yeah. And that was the thing that hit. I mean, there are many reasons why it hurt, but that was one of the reasons why it hurt.
Mm.
Because no one could stand that idea. Like, you know, because there's so much fucking love for him. And we were just kind of like. That thing, the idea that he just couldn't ask for help, that he couldn't, that he wasn't able to let the boundary down enough just to go, like, this is all really fucked up, someone help. That I think really hurt everyone, because, you know, because the fans have so much love for him, and because that love felt like a, you know, and yes, it's not real, we don't know him, but it's not even the people he did know, you know,
right. Yeah, I mean, one of the most striking things about both about Maite's book and about just like general the reaction after Prince's death. I mean, you know, there's been a little bit of squabbling and backbiting, but I mean, for the most part, like, you know, there were pictures of like, you know, Jill Jones and Susan Moonsey and, you know, like all of these women that Prince was like sleeping with at the same time, with their, you know, not, and they weren't happy about it. It wasn't an open relationship, you know?
No, they weren't. They weren't happy about it. And they say they're okay with it now, but I'm still pretty skeptical, to be honest.
Oh, right. And so it's like, they're all like, they're consoling each other. You know, like Maite opens her book with, the first thing she does when she finds out about Prince's death because Manuela texts her about
that
it.
Whole,
you know?
that whole thing's pretty weird, huh?
It's like everybody loved him, you know, and despite the fact that he was a tremendous asshole to so many people, not just women, but, you know, everyone he collaborated with, basically, Morris Day, Jesse Johnson.
And the fans feel exactly the same. I mean, those of us who are prepared to acknowledge that he was an asshole, like it doesn't. I mean, that's what's interesting. Some of the interest that's been interesting about the discussion of Maite's book is like, yeah, he was an asshole. Like, we don't love him any less. Like, we knew he was an asshole.
Exactly.
Before. We loved him before, and we knew he was an asshole, and we still love him and know he's an asshole. Like, it's fine, and that's true of everyone that knew him.
Right.
Which, in to a certain extent, is reassuring insofar as that the thing that we feel connected to in him that inspires our love was also powerful enough for the people that knew him to feel the same way, despite the tendency towards assholery. And also because I think probably the people who were around him could also see that that was a product of his own, you know, that it wasn't malicious, or that it was a product of the structure of his defense mechanisms. And if there is something we can blame him for, it's for the fact that he refused to look at what was underneath that, and that he kept moving and he kept moving away from it. And that's the one place that I'm the choice to keep running away from it rather than at some point confront it directly. He has some responsibility for that, and people can choose. And it, and what he, you know, I mean, to talk about Alex's book, what it was that he was running away from was clearly very painful. And that stays with you. You know, being abandoned like that by your parents at that age will stay with you. And it did. And there wasn't all of the fame and the success and the charisma and everything is not going to undo that wound. The only thing that will undo a wound like that is the direct confrontation with it. And that's really painful, hard work. And you ain't going to be making a lot of music while you're doing it. You're going to be like, you know, lying on the floor in a fetal position with your hands over your head screaming. Yeah. It's not productive. It's not pretty. It's sniveling and depression and a lot of things. But it's understandable why people don't want to go there. And the only reason to go there, really, people only go to that place when they realize when they don't have another option. And his other options were really powerful. And if you think about, you know, the musicology comeback, like, that's a serious, you know, you go to a place as dark as he could have gone to, and that's where he comes out at. Like, you're like, okay, this is all right. I'll do this. This is working.
Right. there's kind of a superficiality to it. You know, the musicology tours were very kind of self-celebratory. It was like, these are all the hits that I wrote. You know, this is, and also on top of that, also like an embracing of – his elder statesman status, you know.
Yeah, and so much he definitely moved back towards that. In some ways it's easy. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's definitely that. It's definitely like an ego thing. And I think he needed that. I mean, that's what's kind of so sweet and affecting about that whole Staples Center standing ovation after the little red Corvette thing, because it's very, you know, it's very touching, because he's been to a dark place and you can see what it means to him. He's like, oh, I survived. It's gonna be okay.
I said, baby, have you got enough class? Oh, no, sing it. Baby, you're much too fast, yeah. Need a love, you need a love that's gonna last, gonna last.
And he didn't stop taking risks. I mean, he still, you know, I'm still much more interested in the one-off performances. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's all of that, and, you know, the O2 and the Las Vegas set and the arena shows, like, I'm not particularly interested in them. I mean, yeah, they're fine, whatever. You're going to stand there and you're going to do your thing and it's great. But, like, to pull off something like Montreux or, you know, the North Sea Jazz performances and even, like, the One Night Alone after shows are phenomenal. They're phenomenal. They're just, you know, I mean, they've got so much energy in them. And these amazing free-ranging, like, you know, 40-minute funk jams with, like, 17 different songs in them. And he's having a ball.
Desperate is a day that is tomorrow. For those who do not know, time has come to whip the dogs that beg, steal, or borrow. The table God has set for his only son. Wicked is the witch that stands for nothing. All the while watching to see you fall, don't they? Deeper than the ditch, it breathes suffering. Like the one right now being dug by them all. Come on, Donna.
But I had a few things I did want to say about Mighty's book. You've covered most of it. Let me see. Okay, what have I not said? There had some points about the kind of the presentation of the romance, and both, like, how I just can't decide whether it's really captivating or really, really creepy.
It's a little of both, I think. Yeah,
it's a little of both. Like I say, I'm a big foofy hippie. Yeah. Like the whole Thunderbolt, like, tuning fork, resonance, like, our souls have met each other 100 times. Like, I'm on the fence about reincarnation, but that feeling when you sometimes meet someone and you're like, oh, it's you. Hello, you. That feeling is a real is a real thing, and it's very powerful when it happens. And who knows whatever the explanation of that is, but like, I get that. And I think she does a very good job of conveying it. And I mean, I think I want to say in general about the book, it's incredibly tender, and she is very, very sassy and funny and warm and witty. And she comes, I mean, I just really liked hanging out with her. I was like, you're great.
Yeah, that's, I felt the same way. I'm glad you mentioned that. I guess you and I were, neither of us were really fans during the whole MPG era.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So like, I just kind of knew that Maite was his wife at the time, and she belly danced, and, you know, she did, that, like, kind of lousy most beautiful boy in the world cover, you know, like, I didn't really have any feelings about her either way, but I just like her. So I really like her.
Yeah.
This is going to sound, you know, I don't mean this in a creepy way, but I just felt like an affection for her coming away from the book.
She comes over, I mean, like I say, with incredible equanimity, as very, very warm, as very smart, as funny, observant, like very, very generous, very artistically committed. And like, I think that comes across really nicely, like the extent to which there was that kind of harmony between them in terms of like their understanding of themselves as artists and what that meant. And that I totally bought. Like, you know, and like, I mean, like, I do not like 90s Prince. I go back, I look at it. There's a few performances here and there, but I like, you know, I just don't like it. I've tried. Yeah. I've tried. It's just not going to work. So even while she's describing the creation of, like, you know, these sets of probably like my least favorite, you know, consecutive of, you know, part of his oeuvre. I still really liked the, you know, like, Three Chains of Gold. I mean, you know, but like, you want to tell me a story about how into it you were making? You know, yeah, right. Great. Like, I'm really, really glad that you were like totally into that. Like, it's bollocks, but I don't care. Like, I don't care. I just love the fact that you were all in. Like, great.
And she's so nice. One of the things that struck me, I was like, she even has nice things to say about Graffiti Bridge. Like, if you've got nice things to say about Graffiti
Bridge.
That
is so sweet. That is so, so sweet. Like, yeah, I mean,
I can see why he married her. She was the one person who liked Graffiti Bridge. Like,
she has nice things to say about everything. I mean, yeah, and like, all fair, there are some good songs in there. Like,
oh yeah,
seven is a great song. All seven, and we'll watch them fall. They stand in the way of love, and we will smoke them all with an intellect and a savoir faire. No one in the whole universe will ever compare. I am yours now, and you are mine, and together we'll love through all. Space and time, so don't cry. One day all seven will die. Whatever, Thieves in the Temple is a great song. The One is actually a great song. I hate that particular version of it. I don't like the video, but like, you know, it stayed in the repertoire, and it stayed in the repertoire for good reasons, and there's really incredible versions of it from later. And, you know, there's good stuff in there, obviously. But I just really like that. I really like that sense of like artistic commitment and harmony and adventure and all of that stuff. And then there's the quest. So I really buy that aspect of the romance, and I really buy the whole kind of, you know, you want to call it soul recognition, you want to call it reincarnation, however you want to describe that, but that sense of meeting someone and having that kind of very deep intuitive kind of connection with them, that I totally buy. There are weird bits of it. The whole hypnosis thing, I've talked about this with various people, and yeah, that's really where my, like, this is somehow really, really sweet and also creepy as all hell. And I don't,
yeah,
I really don't know what's going on with that.
She has a good way of selling, like, without necessarily giving him a pass, but, you know, like, she's good at, like, not judging, but also not endorsing, you know. She makes it, she kind of suggests that, that was what allowed him to, like,
yeah,
be intimate with her, know? Yeah. But at the same time, like, one can't help but notice that he wasn't putting himself under, like, you know, it was a one-sided intimacy, which is what makes it problematic.
I mean, in some ways, it's almost like the whole kind of issue with the tension in his personality that we're trying to work out, like, in a nutshell. It's like, you know,
yeah,
there's one situation in which he was able to, like, drop his boundaries and make himself vulnerable and give up control by doing something which is weirdly incredibly controlling.
Right, exactly, yeah.
I'll give up my control if I can do it while being very controlling.
Right.
and you just, in some ways it's like, oh, and it also just kind of breaks my heart that's the only way he could let it go. And it's like, this woman worships you. Just let go. It will be fine. Like,
and it's so interesting that so much of his music is about submitting, you know, not in an S&M way, but in, like, I mean, he has a fucking song called Let It Go, and, like, some,
yeah, no, so he has a song, he has a song called exactly. I mean, and this is another thing that I had in the list of tensions, the one between control and surrender. Exactly.
Yeah,
like, you look in play,
and he's always playing a submissive role with the woman, you know, like, he's always, like, overwhelmed, allowing himself to be overwhelmed, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, this is exactly the thing. I mean, I don't think it's submissive, but there is complete surrender to his own desire, like,
yeah,
and there's no attempt to kind of, I mean, that's what the whole Beautiful One scene is about. It's this, like, incredibly, like, vulnerable, like, surrender to his own desire, without attempting to, like, push it away or go, I'm going to lose control and it's freaking me out and I can't deal with it. And, like, somehow he could do that. You know, you look at him play a guitar, that is, like, pure surrender. Like, he just puts his head straight back and he just goes into it and he just lets the fuck go. And that's what's so interesting about that tension, that you've got someone whose artistic practice is so, and that's what flow is. It's like, you surrender into it, you just let go. Like, he had an incredible capacity to let go and somehow he couldn't do it in intimate relationships or in his life or in admitting vulnerability to the people close to him. And that's because you look at the work and you would think that was not the case. You would think this was somebody who would be able to sit down and go, I'm feeling really bad. Like,
yeah, right.
I'm feeling really bad. You know, can we talk about it?
Yeah.
I'm in a lot of pain. How should we handle this? No. So that's, you know, it's interesting. The you know, the story that Susan Rogers tells about the beginning of that scene where he records Wally, when she says he comes in and she sees him and she can see that he's in pain and she knows why he's in pain. And she knows that it's not something that you can say to him. Like Mighty says, he's not someone you can bring chicken soup to. Like, you can't go and comfort him when he's hurting. So that's the whole nub of it. Really, I think.
Right. I'm ready for the ring. We'll be back next week with the fourth and final installment of my conversation with Jane Claire Jones. If you've been enjoying the podcast, you can check us out, subscribe on all of the major services, iTunes, Google Play and Stitcher. And it would help us out if you would leave a review, because that makes us easier to find on those services. In the meantime, check out princesongs.org. Thanks for listening. I have long to sing my song, but a horse couldn't drag your ass to put me on. But now I got it, and I'm ahead with 3 million strong.